Liberians running in fear from their loved ones. Today, Thursday, July 31st. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. West Africa struggles to contain a deadly Ebola outbreak. This official in Liberia admits his country needs help.
We simply have never had this kind of attack on our way of life before.
We'll also hear why an Ebola outbreak of this magnitude is not likely to happen here in America.
We do have the capability, by handling patients in the proper way, to prevent that kind of spread.
And later, a New England supermarket chain whose employees come from everywhere.
Iraq, Iran, and from all those people down there, Middle East, Europe, you know, Greek, we got everything.
Now they're all coming together to try to save their old boss. The story's coming up on The World, so stick around.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Imagine you're from the West African nation of Liberia, and just as you're putting decade-old memories behind you of running in fear from gun-toting child soldiers, along comes another menace, Ebola. An outbreak of the highly infectious disease has already claimed more than 700 lives in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. And concern about the disease is also spreading. Today, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control warned Americans not to travel to those three West African nations. In a few minutes, we'll hear more on all this from one of the leading health officials in the U.S., Dr. Anthony Fauci. But first, we're going to keep our focus on Liberia. The government there has taken extraordinary measures to curb the spread of Ebola. That includes shutting down schools and government ministries and putting some areas under quarantine. Lewis Brown is Liberia's Minister of Information.
We do need all of the help we can get. We need hands. We need expertise. We need equipment, and yes, we need money.
Are you worried about how fast that's all going to materialize? Because dozens of local health workers there, including Liberia's top Ebola doctor, have died treating patients. I mean, where will you turn for medical assistance in the meantime?
Well, we're looking inward and we're looking outward. We need counseling. Some of our healthcare workers are frightened. You can understand that not only is this unprecedented, but we simply have never had this kind of attack on our way of life before.
It is the worst Ebola outbreak in the history of the disease. And there are reports we're hearing from Monrovia that one isolation unit is so crowded with cases that 20 new patients had to be treated in their homes. Is that accurate?
Well, yes. This virus has reached against our worst fears, urban and very populated areas. That is why we've had to take some very tough and difficult measures and will not hesitate to continue those measures.
But if people are being treated in their homes, how can you possibly monitor everyone who even comes near these treatment sites?
Well, that's the challenge. The alternative is to have them go to these facilities that are getting overcrowded, because really this disease is overwhelming.
Liberians are also reacting pretty negatively to some controversial measures like a halt on traditional funeral practices. Can Liberians change their way of life so dramatically, so quickly?
We do not expect that suddenly people will change those behavior, but change they must, because that is the surest way of transmitting the disease, to tamper with body fluids of affected individuals, even though they may be loved ones. And that is why we're even considering measures including cremation.
One other thing that a lot of people are reacting to is a suggestion that Liberia quarantine entire communities. Some might say it's essential in a crisis like this. Others say it's just medieval. What is the position of the Liberian government about quarantines?
We have a saying in our neck of the wood: to cure a bad ailment, you need a bad remedy. We do not like some of the things we have to do, but certainly we have to do them. Whether they be deemed medieval, whether they be deemed archaic and ancient, we simply must do it to continue to protect lives. And if we have to even protect loved ones from loved ones, that has to be a duty we have to do. We've had to endure a devastating civil war, and here we are. working as we try to do to recover, and then we get hit by this dreadful virus.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up the civil war in Liberia. I was just wondering how the mood compares right now to that of the mood when rebels were storming the country.
Nothing is like war, but this is war by extension. People are seeing people die. And what is worse is that your loved one gets ill and you cannot touch. We understand that. But it's a war that we had. At least you knew where to run. You knew probably what to hide. But now you're running even from people you love.
Lewis Brown, Liberia's Minister of Information. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you very much.
This Ebola outbreak in West Africa is already the largest ever recorded, more than 700 people dead, as I mentioned earlier, out of 1,300-plus infected. But those numbers aren't the only thing that make this outbreak different. According to Dr. Anthony Fauci, he directs the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health.
This virus was first recognized in 1976, and there have been about almost two dozen outbreaks, which are generally mini outbreaks in rural areas, anywhere from a couple of people to a few hundred people. What we have here now is a multi-country outbreak, which is not only tucked away in rural areas, but has actually now been in cities, so that the capability of this spreading in a much more aggressive way, we're actually witnessing that. So the numbers are the highest ever, that's for sure. It's been across border because of the porous borders. And the countries have such a poor and undeveloped infrastructure for health care that it actually compounds the difficulty because of the spread, which we know goes from person to person. So all of those things together really come forth to just give you what historically now is unquestionably the worst Ebola outbreak that we've had since it was first recognized in 1976.
I don't want to be alarmist about this, but what you just said is pretty alarming. And in light of the recent death of the Liberian-American Patrick Sawyer, who took a plane from Liberia for Nigeria en route to the U.S., he died in Lagos in Nigeria. How probable is it for an infected person to enter the U.S.? How worried should we really be here?
It is certainly conceivable that someone can get infected in a West African country, be without symptoms, get on a plane, and wind up landing in the United States. That being the case, the chances of there being an outbreak are extraordinarily low, and that's the reason why the CDC and myself and other health officials are saying that you don't want to take things lightly at all, and we have to be extremely vigilant. But the conditions that allow for an outbreak, like we're seeing in the African countries, are solely related to the lack of the ability to handle patients in an isolated way with the proper protective equipment.
The United States just issued a travel warning for the three countries largely affected by the outbreak. What other precautions are in place here?
Well, that's it. I mean, the first thing is, as the CDC has done, is to increase the travel alert. But the other issue, I mean, that's for people who are going to these countries. If you look at it on the other side of the coin, is alerting physicians that if they actually come into contact where a person would come in with symptoms that would be suggestive. One of the things in medicine that you learn, and I learned in my first year in medical school, is that take a travel history. So first of all, airlines will be alerted that when they're coming from areas such as the West African countries, if someone gets on board and they're getting sick on the plane, obviously you alert the authorities. In this case, it would be the CDC. Then if in fact someone does land and gets sick after they're here, that's when you have to be sure now, and there's a lot of really radar screen on everybody's radar screen now because of the extraordinary publicity this is getting, that you're alerted to always asking a travel history. And it's that kind of approach, together with the ability to isolate people and to treat them in a way that does not spread, that's why we feel rather confident that we're not going to see an outbreak here, even though there's the possibility that we may have someone travel here who actually is infected.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
You could say that Argentina is in a fight for its financial future. The South American country missed a payment on its debt last night, that after last-minute talks broke down in New York with a group of U.S. hedge fund creditors. Argentina's economy minister later likened the negotiations to extortion. The talks had been ordered to take place by a judge in New York who, in effect, is forcing Argentina to default until a debt deal is reached. This is the second time in 13 years that Argentina has defaulted on its international financial obligations. It's a bit like you or me missing a credit card payment, except this is on a scale of billions of dollars and potentially affecting the financial future of a country of 41 million people. Let's hear how all this is going down in Buenos Aires. Our BBC colleague Veronica Smink is there. First of all, Veronica, how is the government in Buenos Aires reacting to this news? You have some headlines to share with us.
Yes, the government here is very angry because what they're saying is, hey, we've paid. And they have actually paid their bondholders. It's just that the U.S. justice system has frozen those payments, saying, no, you can't pay your creditors until you pay all your creditors. And Argentina has restructured 93% of its debt into swap debts that they did in 2005, 2010. And these are the people they're trying to pay. But Judge Griesa has said, no, you can't pay your bondholders until you pay these hedge funds that are also requesting the full value of their bonds. Now, these hedge funds represent less than 1% of Argentina's total creditors. So Argentina is saying this is a completely unfair situation.
So how about that all or nothing ultimatum? How do Argentines feel about that? Is there immediate reaction, or to them, does it seem kind of like distant storm clouds?
Well, no. In Argentina, the word default brings back, you know, very bad memories from 2001. A lot of people remember what the situation was then, what happened, you know, after Argentina defaulted on its sovereign debt. There was very, very high unemployment, very high levels of poverty. But the situation is completely different because in this case, Argentina is not, in a sense, voluntarily defaulting in the sense that they're saying, look, we have the money, we want to pay. It's just the reason they're saying they can't pay these hedge funds is that if they do that before the end of the year, there will be a clause that will be activated in these two swap debts that I was talking about before. There was this clause, rights upon future offers, it's called, that basically enables the 93% of its creditors who Argentina already agreed with could say, if you pay these hedge funds, I want that same amount. Now, in 2015, that situation, this clause will have expired. So Argentina is saying, give me till 2015, you know, give me a stay so that I can then agree once in 2015, once this clause has expired, then I can agree with the hedge funds. So people here in Argentina are concerned because, you know, a default could mean a worse recession. The country is already in a recession. And also, remember, Argentina has one of the highest inflations in the world, estimated at between 35-40%. So people are really concerned that that could worsen.
When we're talking default on debt in the billions of dollars, Veronica, what is at stake for Argentina with that kind of default? And what could the consequences be?
Well, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, the president, has said, hey, this is such a big difference for us because since the default in 2001, we haven't had much access to credit, which is the main thing that Argentina will lose with this default. But again, the people, you know, ordinary people are not thinking so much about that. They're thinking, how will this affect my daily life? And again, they think this is going to, you know, deepen the recession, make the inflation higher. So all these things are quite worrying. And especially, people are particularly concerned that there could be job losses. Currently, the unemployment levels are, you know, in one digit, less than 10%. And people are concerned that it could be rising and going back to the levels in 2001, which were about 25%. That's their main concern. So there was a sense here that there was going to be an agreement. So people were first surprised that there wasn't an agreement. And secondly, I think today there is a general sense of, oh, God, not another default.
Our old friend in Buenos Aires, Argentina, with the BBC, Veronica Smink. Veronica, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Still ahead on The World, you'll hear why a London city councilman had to drink several pints of ale for work on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. When I need some obscure foreign ingredient for my kitchen, a hot sauce from Belize or a special type of tomatillo, there are all sorts of bodegas I can go to in my neighborhood. or I can just head over to the Market Basket a couple of miles from my house. It's kind of a super bodega. There are 71 Market Basket stores across New England. It's a family-owned chain known for low prices. It's also very successful, earning more than $4 billion in revenue last year. But right now, Market Basket's in disarray. Workers in its stores are actively encouraging customers not to shop there. It's not a labor protest, though. They want to reinstate the chain's CEO. We sent the world's Bradley Campbell to find out why.
I didn't expect to stumble into a scene from Soviet Russia when I walked into my neighborhood grocery store. But that's exactly what I found at the Market Basket in Somerville. Empty shelves and a produce section with absolutely no produce. More than a week later, it's still the same.
We don't have a potato in the building. We don't have a carrot, not a piece of watermelon. We have nothing to sell.
Store manager Mike Dunleavy and I look out at the empty shelves. There's only a couple shoppers in the store, and it's so quiet, you can hear the eerie hum of refrigerator cases. To understand why it's so empty, you have to understand a little bit about the battle for control of the chain. It's playing out between two cousins, both named Arthur Demoulas. Now, last month, the board of directors fired Arthur T., and that's what got employees here so upset.
Arthur T. Demoulas is taking care of his employees like his own family.
To hear from employees like Mike the manager, a guy who started bagging groceries at the store 36 years ago, Arthur T. gave them respect. He also gave them a bonus program, a profit-sharing program, and fantastic benefits. Now, that all translates into loyalty, and that's why there's empty produce shelves. The warehouse is on strike and not doing any deliveries. The workers at this Somerville store are telling their customers to shop elsewhere, and it's having a huge impact. Sales at this store are down 90%. The company is losing millions. All this to bring back Arthur T.
He's not a CEO that sits in a desk and you see him once every 5 years. I'll see him here 5-6 times a year. He'll come in, he'll talk to employees, he'll talk to customers. It's like it's his own family.
That idea of family is strong. At the Somerville store, that family is diverse. Market Basket is known as a place where immigrants come to work and shop. The store stocks a big variety of foods from home, and they keep prices low.
Whatever country you come from, whatever you need or you want, you find it here.
Carla Hernandez came to the U.S. from El Salvador when she was 8. Her family went to Market Basket every Saturday to do their shopping. Her brother ended up getting a job at the store. She followed suit.
So I came here, 16, and I started working in the yogurt section as a dairy department.
That was 17 years ago. She now manages the front of the store. Now, there are lots of stories of immigrants like Hernandez finding a place at Market Basket.
There's like 71 stores, right? If you go to the warehouse, you got all United Nations together there. And it's funny because you get to work with a lot of people in different places. Iraq, Iran, and from all those people down there, Middle East, Europe, you know, we got Greek, we got everything.
Plus, you know that if you step into the Market Basket in Somerville, chances are pretty good that no matter what language you speak, someone will understand you.
It's Portuguese, Brazilian, Haiti, Creole, French, obviously number one Spanish, Greek, we got Nepali, we got everything.
So why would workers from all around the world risk bringing down a massive company that employs them just to reinstate a CEO?
He's dedicated to us, we're dedicated to him.
You can see it on the walls. There are posters of Arthur T. with the words, "I believe," printed underneath. They're a take on the iconic Obama Hope posters. Outside, workers stand in front of the parking lot to protest before their shifts start. One of them is a 19-year-old kid who's only been working at Market Basket for a month. His name is Kevin Perez Barbosa. He waves a flag made of plastic Market Basket bags.
Each day, like, we start from when we come and we end when we close.
Kevin's not the first in his family to work at Market Basket. Years ago, his parents came over from El Salvador and Cape Verde. Like him, both worked at Market Basket in their teens. He's just continuing the tradition.
It's a good place to start off if you want to get a job, and like all the experience you're going to be getting, it could help you out in the future too.
We look out at the empty parking lot. Before the protest, you'd be hard pressed to find a parking spot.
It's killing us, but we're like, we just want the Market Basket to be back to normal.
For the World, I'm Bradley Campbell, Somerville, Massachusetts.
far from Boston, in eastern Ukraine, investigators finally reached the crash site of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. They've been waiting for fighting in the region to stop. Those investigators are hoping to determine who shot down Flight 17. The U.S. says it was probably pro-Russian rebels in Ukraine supplied by Russia. And in the country with most victims, the Netherlands, they're starting to question trade relations with Russia. The BBC's Anna Holligan begins her report from the Aalsmeer flower market.
This is the biggest flower market in the world. Russia is one of the most important customers, but since the introduction of sanctions earlier this year, exports to Russia fell by 10%.
After MH17, Dutch business people like Harman de Boon, chairman of the Dutch Flower Trade Association, are facing a dilemma.
Well, I think the devil's dilemma is because are the economic reasons more important than, let's say, the other reasons, the moral reasons about what's happening there?
Last year, the port city of Rotterdam was the largest destination in the world for Russian goods. The Netherlands is a small nation that relies heavily on foreign trade. So far, influential multinationals like Shell, Philips and Heineken have refused to give any kind of public comment. But we understand they are watching the situation on the ground. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte told us he is ready to increase the pressure on Russia.
We want to prepare another range of sanctions. They will be triggered if Russia will keep on arming the rebels. They will be triggered if at the end of the investigation it would emerge that Russia is behind this. They will be triggered if Russia is not helping in opening up the crash site and putting pressure on the rebels.
So, to what extent will it influence the Netherlands' economic relationship with Russia? Jan Melinson is from the Klingendal Institute of International Relations in The Hague.
Clearly, this has been interpreted as an act of inhumanity on the side of the Russians, and that is where the Dutch feel they have to do what small countries normally don't do, take decisions on the basis of other arguments than economic arguments.
As Russia's third largest trade partner, the Dutch do have some economic clout.
We've come to the weekly farmers' markets outside the Dutch Parliament in The Hague. There are slabs of Edam cheese, eggs, and lots of fresh organic vegetables. The Netherlands does around 30 billion euros worth of trade with Russia every year. But many of the traders here believe it's time to put principle before profit.
I think the people who died is more important than the money we can earn in Russia. Yeah.
It is a delicate situation. The Netherlands may soon have to consider alternative markets.
That was our colleague in the Netherlands, the BBC's Anna Holligan, and you heard Anna on the World from PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Israelis remain largely supportive of the war in Gaza, but some American Jews, especially younger ones, have questions.
Is Israel really treating the Palestinians fairly? Is Israel's blockade of Gaza really entirely justified? Can Israel justify all these civilian casualties, even if it's only going after Hamas?
More on that ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The U.S. is Israel's staunchest ally, but it's clear that Israel's military operations in Gaza are testing the relationship. Today, a White House spokesman described the shelling of a United Nations school in Gaza as totally unacceptable and totally indefensible. Several Palestinian civilians, including children, were killed. Despite such civilian casualties, public support for the war in Gaza remains high among Israelis. But what about the American Jewish community? Peter Beinart follows this closely. He's the author of The Crisis of Zionism, and he says this latest Gaza war is not very popular with the younger generation of U.S. Jews.
It's polarizing American Jews along ideological lines, but also very much along generational lines. And you can see that playing out very much in social media, where younger people are more likely to be online. It's not to say that Israel doesn't have strong defenders amongst younger American Jews. It does, especially from within, more likely from within the Orthodox community. But overall, this general sense that we've had amongst American Jews over the past few years that the intergenerational conversations within families are very difficult on this issue because of different generational experiences, I think this war has made that even more the case than it was before.
So what kinds of things are you hearing from American Jews across those generational lines? Like if we take the millennials, who are obviously very active on social media, and say their parents, who are perhaps less active. I mean, what is that debate all about? What does it sound like?
I think older American Jews are more likely to start with the assumption that the Palestinians have never accepted Israel and basically hate Israel, and that Hamas is a particularly virulent expression of that. And then that added to that is to see the really disturbing rise in anti-Semitism in Europe, and to say that Israel is under assault and we need to stand behind it. Even if we don't support every Israeli policy at this moment, with Israel under assault, we have to stand behind it. And that is particularly resonant for people who in their own lives may have remembered things like 1948 or 1967, may have had personal experiences with anti-Semitism. And so this really resonates for them. I think for younger Americans, they may not reject all of that, but they may be more likely to start with the more universalistic assumption that the Palestinians are not all that different from us, and that the Palestinians have been living without some of the basic rights that we would want ourselves. And while they certainly would not defend Hamas and not defend Hamas rocket fire, might even say that Israel has the right to defend itself, they would say, yeah, but wait a second. Is Israel really treating the Palestinians fairly? Is Israel's blockade of Gaza really entirely justified? Can Israel justify all these civilian casualties, even if it's only going after Hamas? So I think those are, I'm trying to describe it in a way that doesn't prejudice it one way or the other, but I just think these are different perspectives that come out of different life experiences. Younger people have had experienced less anti-Semitism in their own lives, and they've grown up seeing Israel as a powerful country, not a weak country.
I'm 53. I grew up, went to school, and knew very few Arabs or Arab Americans. I think that's changed a lot. I'm wondering if there's, you know, for the younger generation, a greater sense of empathy.
I think you're making also a very important point, right? Since 1965, we've had this big influx of immigrants from around the developing world and from the Muslim world. And I think people going to college today, for instance, or in their 20s, are much more likely to have casual friendships with people, either Palestinians or Arabs or Muslims more generally. And although sometimes, you know, those relationships on college campuses are described in the American Jewish establishment as very hostile, in my experience, actually, they're often quite good. And I think it humanizes people. Again, it's not likely to make them sympathize with Hamas, but I think when you know someone who is Muslim, for instance, you are much less likely to traffic in the kind of very harshly anti-Muslim rhetoric that sometimes you see amongst older American Jews.
And yet the U.S. Senate passed a resolution 100-0 to support Israel's right to defend itself. Do you think they're not taking, lawmakers in Washington are not kind of taking into account the debate that's actually going on among American Jews?
It was actually a really extraordinary resolution if you look at it. The Senate and House resolution did not even make reference to the fact that any Palestinians had died. I mean, you would not even know from reading that resolution that any Palestinians had died. It was truly an appalling document. And it is really remarkable when you think about it that someone like an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders, who's a socialist, for goodness sakes, or Al Franken all supported that resolution. Do I really believe in their heart of hearts that's what they believe? No, I don't. I mean, I can't prove it, but I don't actually believe that that's what they really think in their heart of hearts. But I think that American politicians have made a calculation that the hassle that you get from taking a position that is at odds with the organized pro-Israel community, American Jews, but also to some degree evangelical Christians, is just a headache that most people don't want to deal with. And the political price on the other side is virtually nil. I mean, Palestinian, Arab, Muslim Americans are not an influential constituency in Washington. And liberal American Jews, while they've become organized more through J Street,
essentially have nowhere to go. I mean, they're not going to vote for a Republican.
A lobby group in Washington.
J Street is a dovish lobby group in Washington. But those people are not going to vote for a Republican, right? So even if the Democratic senator, who's liberal on other things, is a little bit more supportive of Benjamin Netanyahu than they would like, they don't have an alternative. Remember, the Democrats do not have a culture of primary challengers like the Republicans do. So a Democratic senator is basically pretty safe from challenge on the left on this issue right now. That could change in the future.
I mean, final question, bottom line here. Is the current Israeli war with Gaza a before and after moment, generally speaking, for U.S. Jews and their relation to Israel?
I wouldn't put it that starkly, but I think there is a longer-term transition, and this is one moment in that transition. It is the transition to a younger generation of American Jews who, first of all, don't see Israel as a refuge from anti-Semitism in the way their parents may have. Mm-hmm. Secondly, are more likely to see Israel, and Jews more generally, as a powerful and privileged community rather than a weak and menaced community. And thirdly, because they have much less social distance in their own personal relationships from Gentiles, and indeed from Arabs and Muslims, are less likely to feel like criticism has to be kept in-house, that you can only criticize among Jews. You know, younger American Jews don't do anything virtually only among Jews. So they, unlike their parents or grandparents, are more likely to feel comfortable with more public criticism. What I hope is that some of those instincts, which lead them to challenge Israeli policy, can be coupled with a sense of wonder and affection for the project of Israeli statehood.
Peter Beinart, the author of The Crisis of Zionism, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Until recently, the West Bank remained relatively quiet, with only small protests over the mounting death toll in neighboring Gaza. That changed last week when thousands of Palestinians took to the streets of the West Bank. There have been more demonstrations since then, and some protesters are calling for a third intifada. Rebecca Collard has a story from Ramallah.
A thousand Palestinians march through the narrow streets of the Qalandia refugee camp, carrying the body of 17-year-old Mohammed Araj. His body is wrapped in a Palestinian flag. Mohammed was one of three people killed by Israeli fire at a protest here last week. It was the biggest demonstration the West Bank has seen in years. More than 10,000 Palestinians came to the Qalandia checkpoint, the main one between Jerusalem and the West Bank, to protest Israel's ongoing assault on the Gaza Strip. Richard Zanzananari is here for Mohammed's funeral. I meet him outside the tent where the Araj family is accepting condolences. He says Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have lost too much in the past 3 weeks to return to the oppressive status quo.
What we have to say for our martyrs, what we have to say for our injured people, what do we have to say for our prisoners? So I don't think that this will go back to the first square. On the contrary, it's going to be bigger and bigger.
Some at the funeral say the only thing standing between the West Bank and a third intifada is the lack of strong leadership.
You know, the people are just waiting for someone to organize them. As soon as they heard that there was going to be a protest with this large of a scale, they were ready to go.
This 18-year-old asked to be called Hossam. He says people are tired of waiting for the Palestinian Authority to do something.
People are just getting sick of the occupation. They're getting sick of the PA and how it's trying to control the people. People just, you know, they just want third intifada. They want to rise again. PA aren't really interested in the third intifada.
But some say there's already an uprising underway, a nonviolent one. Mustafa Barhouti is a politician in Ramallah and head of the Palestine National Initiative.
This new uprising is different from the two previous ones. That's what many people don't recognize, and that's why they don't understand. They don't know. Is it an uprising? It's not an uprising. It's an intifada, not an intifada. It's an uprising. But it's mainly in the West Bank and is peaceful, nonviolent, and comes in waves.
The nonviolent approach has helped the Palestinian Authority maintain a degree of autonomy in the sliver of the West Bank that's under its control. And while major Palestinian factions got behind last week's protest here, the Palestinian Authority is unlikely to welcome a sustained uprising. And they're not the only ones here. Many who live here in the West Bank, particularly in Ramallah, have to weigh their salaries and children's education against the cost of taking to the streets. Sama Salim is sitting in a restaurant in Ramallah. She's a 20-year-old student finishing her degree in the U.S.
I think that people here are just, you know, you live your basic life. You go to work, you go out at night, and it's deceiving. It's kind of it is deceiving. It blinds you from what's going on.
Activists have accused the PA of placating West Bank Palestinians with mortgages and car loans.
I think that people in Ramallah is just, they kind of get what it's like to live a normal life. Not absolutely normal, definitely not, but they know what it's like and they don't want to give that up.
But that's no longer the case for the thousands of people who protested in recent days, and discontent can be infectious. Still, it seems the Palestinians' own leadership might be the biggest barrier to a new uprising. Palestinian protesters have clashed with Palestinian police several times in recent weeks. In addition to Israel, a third intifada could also be a challenge to the Palestinian Authority, and the stones and chants of an uprising could be directed at them. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Ramallah.
Saleh Darkhalil used to live in Ramallah, but when the situation got bad there after the second intifada, his family decided to leave. They moved from the West Bank to Kansas City, Missouri. It was 2002 and Saleh was 13 years old. As part of our ongoing look at immigrants' first days in the United States, Saleh tells us his story.
When I came here, I was in the 8th grade and September 11 had just happened. Let alone just being like a Muslim kid in a Midwestern school, it was difficult. My brother and I would go to school together on the same bus. So we would sit next to each other, but then we have all these kids around just staring and making fun of both of us. You terrorist kids or something like that, or is Osama your uncle? And they just, everybody on the bus just breaks out laughing, you know. I really didn't know what to do. And again, my English was not perfect. It was not that good to kind of defend myself or just trying to give them an idea of, no, that's not me. I don't do that. I'm still a kid. It was hard. It was really hard, the whole thing. And then we go to high school. Toward the end of my sophomore year in high school, it was a lot easier. We started getting other non-English speaking students. I guess the attention shifted from me to them. So I would try to help these kids out. There's this one kid that I remember, he was from Mexico. He spoke no English at all, like not even just simple words, nothing. And I didn't know any words in Spanish. So I found it easier because again, he needed the credit and he needed to just get by. So I was like, you know what, just copy me, man. I know it sounds horrible, but I felt bad for these kids because I understood exactly what they are going through. By that time, I had a lot of friends, and in-school friends, of course. And I joined the soccer team, so it was nice just to get the feeling of these kids. Like, oh, all right, so we're playing soccer together. Another thing that I was looking forward to when we have a history class are the movies that we had to watch, like The Patriot, for example. That was like one of the movies that I loved so much, like with Mel Gibson and things like that.
Margaret, I want you to hide in the field with William and Susan. If we're not back by sunset, I want you to take them to your Aunt Charlotte's. Is that clear?
I don't know. It was just something about, if you will, how the States got on their way to freedom and things like that. And when we first watched that movie, I just got so emotional. I actually remember actually tearing up when, in the movie, Mel Gibson, I don't know what the character's name was, he loses one of his kids and then they attack his home. Kind of touch a nerve. I felt so connected to it in a way. Oh man, Palestine is being occupied and they're having the war over there and people are dying every day. And I just hope that this movie would actually transfer into reality without all the killing and all that stuff. Just Palestine becomes free. I hope that happens in my lifetime.
Saleh went on to college and now works as an English teacher, still in Missouri. So, do you have a story about your first days in America, or maybe your family does? Let us know. Visit PRI.org/firstdays or join the conversation on Twitter. Look for the hashtag firstdays. Before we head to the break, I want to tell you about a great story we've got coming up tomorrow. How many new species do you reckon scientists uncover each year?
40 or 50,000 new species are being described every year.
Wow. That is a lot. And all those species need one thing, a name. And researchers who get to name their discoveries have their own particular interests and affiliations. So tune in tomorrow. You'll find out why there's a beetle named after George Bush, a horsefly named after Beyonce, and wait for it, a fish parasite who shares the name of reggae legend Bob Marley. You're listening to The World on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. In Iraq, the advance of the Sunni extremists known as the Islamic State may have slowed down a bit lately, but in Baghdad, militant attacks seem to be on the rise. The targets are often busy markets or Shia holy sites, places where high civilian casualties are more likely, and the police are also frequent targets. Susanna George reports from one Baghdad neighborhood that's bearing the brunt of the attacks.
Baghdad's police force has their hands full these days, especially these guys, the 8th Brigade of the Federal Police. They're responsible for Qadamiya, a Shia neighborhood in North Baghdad that's home to a revered shrine. Qadamiya has been repeatedly targeted by car bombings in recent weeks. The group that's taken responsibility for these attacks, the Islamic State. Along with a coalition of other armed Sunni groups, this is the same organization that now controls Mosul and Tikrit in northern Iraq. General Malik Maliki of the Federal Police patrols this area. Just in the space of 3 days, he's lost 10 of his men. Two were killed at this checkpoint just hours before our visit. General Maliki says he's already lost a lot of officers to the attacks, and he knows he'll lose more. The wall behind us bears fresh shrapnel scars and dried blood. The general says all he can do now is work to get revenge. But he admits that without specific intelligence, when an attack is coming and where, the best he can do is try to prevent the bombs from getting past the checkpoints into crowded markets or Shia holy sites. Even before Mosul fell, these officers weren't doing standard police work, like pulling over speeding drivers. They were breaking up terrorist cells and criminal gangs. But now, with a larger, closer threat, the unit stretched. Outside the brigade's base, known as Camp Cook when it was being used by American troops, a scruffy batch of new volunteers is waiting to be processed. They're all in civilian clothes, some wearing sandals. They'll enter a 2-week police training program before being sent to man checkpoints and patrol streets in some of the most dangerous parts of town, the district's northern edge. And inside the main building, the walls are lined with pictures of the division's martyrs, men killed in the line of duty. An officer points to a panel further down the hall listing 62 names. It's full now, no more space for the men killed just the night before. The officer says they're planning to put up another board. For The World, I'm Susanna George in Baghdad.
Susanna's reporting from Baghdad is part of the World's partnership with Global Post. You can find more of her Iraq stories at PRI.org. Finally today, what do Lindsay Lohan and British politician Steve O'Connell have in common? They've both worn alcohol monitoring ankle bracelets. In 2010, Ms. Lohan was sentenced to wear one by a California judge as punishment for driving infractions, and Steve O'Connell wore his today in front of members of the press in London. O'Connell is a member of London's General Assembly, and he was introducing to his city a new American-inspired program. It allows judges to sentence people convicted of alcohol-related offenses to wear a sobriety ankle bracelet that senses and reports alcohol use. Binge drinking and alcohol-related crime is a huge and costly problem in the UK, and O'Connell wanted to show that the ankle bracelet works as a tool to combat that.
It's the first time in the UK this scheme has been introduced, and I was wearing it for a couple of days, just in essence to highlight the launch today. So as someone who likes his real ale, I've had a couple of pints over the last couple of days, so that when the tag was removed today in front of the press, it showed the result that if a guy who had had a sentence and had the tag and had broken, in essence, the curfew, what it would have actually looked like. Every half an hour, it measures your body to see if you've taken alcohol and registers that.
And it registers that through the sweat?
Yeah, basically, it measures it through the sweat that exudes from your body that has an alcohol content. It picks it up, registers it, notes it, and sends it off to the centre.
Your area of London that you represent is Croydon in South London. What kind of problems do you have there? It's going to be one of the beta test sites.
We're piloting it across four boroughs. There's 32 boroughs in London. And the reason we're using those four boroughs is, one, they've got the same judiciary, so the magistrates and the courts will be able to use this sanction in the same courthouses, in essence. And the four boroughs have all got really vibrant town centres, which sometimes comes with problems. So we thought those four boroughs would be an ideal place to start the pilot.
What's happening in London, it's not really about drinking and driving, is it?
In London, as in many cities, there is crime related to drink. And what we want is the ability to pass a punitive sentence, which in essence says you've got to stay sober. But if you breach that, you get hauled up in front of the court for a more severe sentence. And if this works, I think this would be a good thing for London.
Do you hope that this is going to curb public drunkenness, this ankle bracelet scheme?
Yeah, I hope it's going to curb criminal acts or violence that are linked to alcohol. I don't think at a sweep it will cure public drunkenness, but at the wrong end of it, i.e. the violent end, where people could actually commit acts of criminality, hopefully this will be something that will stop that.
So you wore this bracelet for 2 days. What does it feel like around your ankle? Because if it's measuring sweat, you can't have a sock on, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, during the day it's fine. You sort of kind of forget about it. But every 30 minutes it takes a measure of your sweat and potential alcohol. And it sort of buzzes and vibrates every 30 minutes. And we've got some pretty hot weather over here, unusually for us. And being a light sleeper, it sort of buzzes away in the night. So that's not over brilliant, but I knew for a fact I only had it 2 days, so it didn't really bother me.
Yeah, who knew what Lindsay Lohan was going through? Wow.
Yeah, who knows indeed. First time anyone said I had something in common with Lindsay Lohan, but there you are.
Steve O'Connell, thank you very much for your time.
You're very, very welcome. It's insane the way the name growing, money keep flowing. Hustlers moving silent, so I'm
tiptoeing. So keep blowing, I got it locked up like Lindsay Lohan. That's Cuban-American rapper Pitbull. Sorry, Lindsay Lohan, we're only the DJ. And that's all for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. And I might take you home with me if I could tonight. And baby, I'ma make you feel so good tonight. Cause we might not get tomorrow.
World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.